Well, thank you, Fritz, and it's wonderful to be back with you all. And I'm always cognizant of the first session in this short series, and it is a bit of a, well, as someone mentioned, an information dump last week, and I'm always aware of that, but it's so so much of that material is essential for what we're going to be talking about this morning and next week as well. But we will slow down, all right? And we also have some slides that you can follow along with. Also, I believe there was a outline, a pretty detailed outline of what we'll be discussing this morning, posted on the Harvester's website as well. I just wanted to mention, last night, my wife and I and some friends went and saw the new movie about C.S. Lewis, the most reluctant convert. Has anyone else seen that? Oh, great. Great. So the word must have been circulating here at Perimeter. Good. So I wish I could interact with you. I wish we had the time to interact and talk a little bit about that. But for those of you who have not seen it, I'd highly recommend it. And probably you would enjoy it to the utmost were you had you read in the past C.S. Lewis's sort of quasi-autobiography called Surprised by Joy. And if you're familiar with Surprised by Joy, that book, and some of his writings, I think you would get so much out of that movie. So if you have an opportunity, I'd certainly highly recommend it. Now, basically, last week we talked about three major topics in particular. One was the motives for English colonization of North America, and we talked about how that among these motives were the personal and economic factors. In other words, a lot of people came to the 13 colonies. Hoping to start a new life and a better life than what they had had in England. We talked about how that some came for political reasons to escape tyranny, the tyranny of the local monarchs, in particular King James I and his successor Charles I, and also to escape the tyranny and then the intrusive oversight of local officials back in England. So that was certainly a factor. Now, as far as England itself and the government promoting colonization, that was to enhance the national interest, of course, to build up England's wealth and power and prestige and status in the world. But then there was a fourth factor, which really only relates to a minority of those who came to America, but a very, very significant minority, and that's the religious factor, people who came seeking religious freedom. We talked about how that colonial America was definitely a sociological potpourri, you might say. There was a mix of social and political and religious motives, and likewise, people would come for all those reasons, as I mentioned. There's also a lot of debtors back in England who will choose to come to America and start a new life. Some criminals. Some, however, were very solid middle-class professionals, farmers, artisans, and craftsmen, and so on. In fact, some of England's best people, some of their best, some of their most industrious and talented people choose to come and start a new life in North America as well. And then, of course, again, very, very devout Christians will be instrumental in the founding. Now, having mentioned that last factor, devout Christians, colonial America, as I mentioned last week, was absolutely the most religiously diverse civilization in the entire world. We had mainline Protestants coming from England, everything from mainstream Anglican Episcopalians to Puritan Anglicans. When they came to America, oftentimes they associated with the Congregationalist churches in New England. But these were those who originally had hoped to reform or purify what they considered to be a very decadent church in England, the official state church. We also had, of course, Presbyterians, Lutherans, and eventually Around the time of the American Revolution, many Methodists will eventually either migrate to America or be converted to the Methodist faith. We also talked about how Roman Catholics played a role in early American history up to the time of the Revolution. They were a very small minority, but nonetheless significant. And then we ended last week talking about what's called the Free Church or the Nonconformist tradition. And this would include groups like Baptists, Quakers, Anabaptists, in other words, Mennonites, Amish, Hutterites, groups like that. And then we finished with what's generically referred to as the Separatists, or as we'll be talking about this morning, the Pilgrims who found Plymouth Colony. And by the time of the American Revolution, Americans generally enjoyed more religious freedom than any other people in the world. And I'd like to begin this morning with what last week was sort of our postscript, and that is the Free Church legacy and their major contributions of some of these nonconformist groups. Alternate churches such as the Separatists had a remarkable impact on American religious history. Despite being minority traditions, they were often subjected to discrimination by the established state churches. Their emphasis, however, on religious liberty and separation of church and state eventually prevailed. And as we talked about last week, this term separation of church and state has been so perverted, so corrupted in the last century, century and a half. We're referring to separation of church and state as originally conceived. And they were major proponents of that concept. Now, in addition, these churches contributed significantly to the spirit of healthy democratic debate and competition in American Christian life at that time. One historian, Earl Radmacher, puts it this way: the ecclesiology of the free churches has had the most notable influence on the growth and development of the church in America. And likewise, I would note that, for instance, to cite one other Christian group and their influence, the Presbyterian form of church government. You probably are well aware of this. The Presbyterian form of church government, Presbyterian polity, basically, influenced the American form of government that was established as a constitutional republic. So a great contribution of the Presbyterians as well. Well, this morning, let's take a look here specifically at the founding of Plymouth Colony and what are generically referred to as the Pilgrims. And again, these are religious separatists. Now, about 5 years, as far as we can tell, about 5 years prior to the arrival of the Pilgrims, in other words, around 1615, a French ship wrecked off the coast of Massachusetts. Several of the French crewmen struggled ashore, where local natives killed most of them and enslaved the rest. Now, one of the survivors warned his captors, quote, "God is angry with you for your wickedness, and God will destroy you and give your country to another people." Again, this is 5 years before the Pilgrims arrive. Well, the Indians laughed at him. They said that they were so numerous that the white man's God could not possibly kill them off. And he replied, quote, "God has many ways to destroy ye that ye know not of." Very interesting. Within a year, an epidemic struck that part of the Massachusetts coast, killing over 90% of the native inhabitants. And as thousands died, the natives' faith in their traditional religion was also very much affected, very much shaken. So let's turn our attention here to the Separatists, the so-called Pilgrims who found Plymouth Colony. These are, again, radical nonconformists. They believe that the Anglican Church is too corrupt to be reformed. And so they'll advocate a return to what they would consider to be the simplicity of New Testament Christianity and the autonomy of each local congregation. They were never very numerous in England. In fact, at most, there were probably 5,000, 6,000, 7,000 in all of England during this period. But again, they are very, very significant in terms of subsequent Christian history and subsequent American Christian history as well. Now, the Pilgrims, who eventually came to Plymouth, had been part of a separatist congregation that was formed in the early 1600s in the little village of Scrooby, England. And the leader of this church group was a man named John Robinson. You see his picture there on the slide. Robinson was highly educated. He was a graduate of Cambridge University, and originally he'd been ordained as a priest in the Anglican Church. But like a lot of other nonconformists at that time, Robinson came to believe that the state church of England was totally unreformable, and he finally broke with the church in 1606. Now, that same year, 1606, the Christian congregation there in Scrooby voted to sever all its ties with the Church of England. And at the time, the church was meeting in the home of a man named William Brewster. You probably recognize that name from Pilgrim history. And Brewster was also not only a friend of John Robinson, but he also was a Cambridge graduate himself. So they had within their small little congregation some very highly educated and certainly very, very devout Christian leaders. Now, another notable figure included in that group was a man named William Bradford. And years later, of course, he will be the governor of Plymouth Colony for most of its first 40 years. He also will write a book, kind of a history of the Plymouth Colony, entitled Of Plymouth Plantation. But in total, that Scrooby congregation only amounted to about 100 people at most. Now, as we talked about last week, under Queen Elizabeth, remember the dates of her reign from the late 1550s into the early 1600s. She dies in 1603 and is succeeded by King James I. But under Queen Elizabeth, religious dissenters, as you remember, were constantly being harassed, imprisoned, deprived of property, driven into exile. Sometimes they were even executed. And you might also recall from last week that in the year 1592, Parliament passed what was called the Religion Act. And this Religion Act prohibited separatists from holding their own church services under penalty of fine, imprisonment, and even exile from England. Now, with Queen Elizabeth dying in 1603 and being succeeded by King James I, the situation actually grew even worse under King James. And the persecution of these nonconformists intensified under his reign. So late in 1607, about 100 of these separatists managed to slip out of England. By the way, it was illegal to immigrate. They basically had to do this covertly. So they slip out of England under cover of darkness, by the way, and they immigrate to Holland. And the congregation, first of all, settled in the city of Amsterdam. And they began to integrate into an existing congregation of nonconformists that called itself the Ancient Church. Again, a lot of the impetus behind all this was to, in their minds, get back to the formation, the style, and the spirit of the early church in Christian history. So these pilgrims will settle in Amsterdam. But personal and theological arguments soon erupt among the members of the congregation, and it forces these Scrooby separatists to relocate in the city of Leiden, Holland. This was reputed to be the most tolerant city in Holland at the time, and Leiden harbored thousands of Protestant refugees, in addition to these nonconformists. Even Catholics occasionally would seek refuge in Leiden, Holland. Years later, William Bradford would describe the separatist refugees as, quote, pilgrims and strangers upon the earth. And he's basically borrowing from Hebrews 11:13. So in his mind, these people are true Christian pilgrims, strangers upon the earth, totally out of sync with the mainstream mentality of their society and culture. Now, this group in Holland was soon joined by John Robinson and William Brewster, and eventually their community numbered several hundred people. And they actually lived there in Leiden for about 12 years. They learned trades. They enjoy very friendly relations with the neighbors. But eventually, they felt compelled to leave. Now, why would they want to leave Holland, probably the most truly liberal and tolerant country in the world at the time? Well, first of all, these people are English. They're not Dutch. And as foreigners, they never really felt at home in Holland. Many found it difficult to obtain suitable employment. Even though Holland's a very permissive, tolerant society, there's still some prejudice toward other people, Germans, English, Irish, you know, otherwise. And so they were having a difficult time making ends meet, most of them. They also feared that their children were being corrupted because this very tolerant Dutch society was also very, very permissive. It was the most liberal, to use the current terminology, of any nation in Europe at the time. And so a lot of these English separatists began to notice that their children were basically adopting Dutch values, including a lot of disrespect toward their parents. And some of the children eventually, once they became teenagers, would drift off. They'd become sailors or soldiers, and that did not set well with the separatists either. And as William Bradford later recounted, some of the children were, quote, drawn away by evil examples into extravagant and dangerous courses of life and departing from their parents so that they saw their posterity would be in danger to degenerate and to become corrupted. So that was another reason why they were looking for another home in which to establish their community. Now, a couple of other factors. There had been a 12-year-long peace treaty between Spain and Holland, or the Netherlands, and that peace treaty ended in 1619. And there were rumors at that point that the Spanish were preparing to invade the Low Countries, Belgium and Holland. So that was a cause for great concern. And in addition, a less tolerant Dutch government came to power in 1619. So the separatists feared that great miseries, in their words, great miseries might possibly befall us in this place. So they're eager to get out of Holland, but they can't return to England because they'd be subjected to all the same abuse that they had in previous years. So in desperation, the separatists consider immigrating to America. But a major concern was, how would they be accepted by the local residents here, what they called the savages in North America? And William Bradford put it this way. He warned that he warned his group that Indians were, quote, cruel, barbarous, and most treacherous, furious in their rage, and merciless in war. Separatists were told that Indians are not content only to kill, but they delight to torment men in the most bloody manner, such as flaying alive, skinning alive, or cutting off the members and joints of the body one by one, broiling them and eating them in front of their victims. Okay. Now, other than that, it seemed like possibly a very hospitable place to settle, start a new life. But despite what Bradford had said, the more immediate threat was on the part of Catholic Spain. And Bradford would describe Spain as being potentially as cruel as the savages in America. So he put it this way. It was granted the dangers of immigrating to America were great, but not desperate. And the difficulties were many, but not invincible. For although there were many dangers likely, yet these dangers were not absolutely certain. It might be that some of the things feared might never befall them. And Bradford writes later, they lived here in Holland, but as men in exile and in a poor condition, and as great miseries might possibly befall them in this place. For the 12 years of truce, between Holland and Spain, were now out, and there was nothing but beating of drums and preparing for war, the events whereof are always uncertain. And then he writes, the Spaniards might prove to be as cruel as the savages of America, and the famine and pestilence as sore here as there, and liberty less to look out for as a remedy. So feeling trapped in Holland, the separatists prepare to leave and emigrate to America. And in fact, the year after the separatists left Holland, in fact, Spain did invade Holland. And of course, the Spanish were absolutely ruthless in their treatment of not only Protestants in general, but these nonconformists as well. Now, in England, there was a man named Edward Sandys. He was a very devout Puritan. He was a shareholder in the Virginia Company that had founded the Jamestown colony several years earlier. And Edward Sandys devised a plan for the separatists to emigrate to North America and settle in what they called the northern parts of Virginia, in other words, the Chesapeake Bay region. And in return, they were promised that if they would leave England, King James would stop harassing them. And so they contract with a local capitalist entrepreneur, a man named Thomas Weston, and he was also a sympathizer toward the separatists, among other things. And he agreed to finance their pilgrimage to America. And in return, they'd pay Weston and other investors in the London Company to prepare shiploads of timber and beaver furs once they began to develop their economy here in North America. And so over the summer, the separatists sold their houses and other goods to prepare for the journey to North America. And in September of 1620, two ships set sail from Plymouth to northern Virginia. Now, one was called the Speedwell. And the Speedwell, unfortunately, failed to live up to its name. Now, by the way, this ship, the Speedwell, according to the accounts, this ship was 30 feet long. That's 10 yards long. That's only two-thirds of the distance between home plate and the pitcher's mound in Little League. So they call that a ship. It was basically just a tub, a floating tub. And fortunately, it sprang a leak because it probably would have sunk anyway on the trip across the Atlantic Ocean. And it had to return to port. So that left just one ship, the Mayflower. Now, the Mayflower was a medium-sized ship. It was about 100 feet long. But again, that's tiny. Think of the distance between home plate and first base. That's 90 feet. This ship's only 100 feet long. And in that ship, they crammed 102 passengers. And these men were preparing for the transatlantic voyage. Now, only 41 of these 102 passengers were actually pilgrims or separatists, part of John Robinson's congregation. The other 61 were various, quote, strangers, including 14 indentured servants and various artisans and so on. Now, their intended destination is Chesapeake Bay, Northern Virginia, as they called it back then. But they were blown off course in their travels across the Atlantic, and they landed several hundred miles, as you know, north of Chesapeake Bay. And reportedly, as they sailed out of sight of England, the passengers aboard the Mayflower looked out, looked back, and waved goodbye and would exclaim, "Farewell, Babylon." See, they were absolutely convinced that England was decadent. It was only pseudo-Christian, along with the rest of Europe. And what they want to do is establish a new Jerusalem. These are very, very devout Christians. That's their agenda. So sailing out of sight of England, it's farewell forever to Babylon. And they're hoping to establish a new Jerusalem in the new world. Well, this voyage lasted almost 10 weeks. And it was so turbulent that the passengers were confined to the lower decks, where they basically lived in abject filth. Many of them became sick, and the stench, we're told, was absolutely unbearable. After an exhausting journey in which the Mayflower again was blown off course, it finally landed at Cape Cod Bay, November 9th, 1620. Now, you might wonder, wait a minute, why did they start this journey in September of the year? They only arrive in early November, about the time that winter is beginning to settle in. And that's just an indication of how desperate these people were. To arrive in winter, no time to plant or harvest any crops for sustenance or anything like that. And so by the time they land there off the coast of Cape Cod Bay, many of the passengers are suffering from disease and malnutrition, winter setting in, and besides, they were also out of beer. Now, years later, William Bradford recorded their hopes and fears upon landing in such a desolate and hostile environment. And he writes this again in his Chronicle of Plymouth Plantation. You see it in your notes there. I'm not sure that it made the PowerPoints, but it is in the written notes. This is what Bradford wrote. Being thus arrived in a good harbor and brought safe to land, they fell upon their knees and they blessed the God of heaven, who had brought them over a vast and furious sea and delivered them from all the perils and miseries thereof, again to set their feet on firm and stable earth, their proper element. He goes on to say, but here I cannot but stay and make a pause and stand half amazed at this poor people's present condition. And so I think will the reader also, when he well considers the same. Being thus passed over a vast ocean and a sea of troubles before in their preparations, as may be remembered by that which went before, they now had no friends to welcome them, no inns to entertain or refresh their weather-beaten bodies, no houses or much less towns to repair to seek for succor. What could not sustain them but the Spirit of God and His grace? May not and ought not the children of these fathers rightly say, quote, our fathers were Englishmen who came over this vast ocean and were ready to perish in this wilderness, but they cried out unto the Lord, and He heard their voice and looked on their adversity and their miseries. Let them therefore praise the Lord, because God is good. His mercies endure forever. Now, like the Puritans in general, who followed them over to America a few years later and established Massachusetts Bay Colony and so on, some members of this group argued that they were outside the jurisdiction of the Virginia Company, which was part of the original contract, you recall. So led by some elders, John Carver, William Brewster, William Bradford, and some others, 41 adult men signed the Mayflower Compact. The compact became the basis for a representative government based on the rule of law and the consent of the governed. And so you might say that this had a very direct impact on the form of government that the founding fathers eventually will implement here in the United States. John Carver, one of those who was most involved, died pretty early on, and William Bradford succeeded him as governor, and in fact, Bradford would be the governor of Plymouth Colony for most of the next 40 years. Now, unfortunately, Bradford's wife had slipped overboard on the Mayflower just as the ship weighed anchor in Plymouth Harbor, and her body was never recovered. So he'll live the rest of his life, you know, without her. Some speculate that she might have succumbed to depression and actually committed suicide by just jumping overboard. So they finally disembark on the coast of southern Massachusetts on November 21st, and they settle in a region called Pawtuxet. It was a former Indian village, a former Wampanoag village that had been wiped out 3 or 4 years earlier by that plague that I mentioned. But the fields were already cleared. They were ready for planting, which the settlers interpreted as a sign that God had prepared the way for them. Furthermore, there were no natives, including any hostile natives, in the immediate area. So they worked very hard throughout that winter, building several houses, hunting game, and so on. By March, nearly half of them, however, had already died of exposure and malnutrition. Only 5 of the 18 original wives survived the winter, that first winter. And 4 families were wiped out altogether. Of the 29 single men, only 10 survived the winter. And then one day in March, 1621, an unexpected guest arrives. He's a Wampanoag native by the name of Samoset. He startles the settlers with the first words out of his mouth, "Welcome, English." They weren't expecting that. And this is how William Bradford put it. Quote, "An Indian walked out of the woods and through the fields into Plymouth. He was Samoset, who spoke some English, having learned it from English fishermen on the coast of Maine. He asked, the first thing he asked for was, 'Do you have any beer?' And the pilgrims gave him some strong water, along with a biscuit, butter, cheese, pudding, and a piece of duck. Now, it was Samoset who proceeded to tell them the old Indian name for their village and explained what had happened to the original inhabitants, who had really just died in the last 3 or 4 years. A few years later, Samoset returned with another native. This is the famous Squanto. Squanto, one of the most important people in all of early American history, he probably saved this colony from abject extinction. William Bradford referred to Squanto as a special instrument sent from God for our good. And again, like Samoset, Squanto spoke English. 6 years earlier, it's an interesting story, 6 years earlier, Squanto had been kidnapped along with a few other natives by an English trader, a man named Thomas Hunt, who sold him as a slave in Spain. Now, Squanto was bought by, it turned out, a very humane Spanish monk who treated him very charitably and introduced him to the Catholic faith. Now, with that, this Spanish monk proceeds to sell Squanto to another Englishman, a man named John Slaney. John Slaney apparently was a very decent person. He took pity on Squanto. He arranged transport for Squanto on an English ship that was exploring the coast of North America. So finally in 1619, Squanto returned back home. And his native village at the time, Pawtuxet, though, was, of course, wiped out by the plague by then. Now, English explorer who brought Squanto back was a man by the name of Thomas Dermer. And Dermer later wrote, quote, "We passed along the coast where we found some ancient Indian plantations, not long since populous, but now utterly void. When we arrived at my savages' native country," talking about Squanto, "we found everyone who formerly had lived there had died." So soon after arriving, Squanto begins to introduce this Thomas Dermer to the local Indian chief in the region, the Wampanoag chief by the name of Massasoit. And of course, he'll also play a key role in the history of the Pilgrims as well. Now, soon after Squanto's visit, the Wampanoag chief Massasoit did arrive along with about 60 other men. The natives assumed that the English had come to avenge the death of previous English who had been slaughtered by local natives. But when they found out that that was not their motive and their agenda at all, then they were able to relax. And although their peace negotiations were rather tense, the two parties agreed to a pact, the Pilgrims and the local Wampanoags. Over the succeeding months, Squanto showed the colonists where to fish and hunt and how to plant and harvest corn. So the question sometimes comes up, now, why did these local Wampanoag even tolerate these English in the first place? Why didn't they just exterminate them as soon as they got off the ship? Well, at the time, the Wampanoags lived in fear of the English god, because remember what had happened just 3 or 4 years earlier, and that eerie prophecy by that Frenchman. The pilgrims later learned that Squanto had warned the Wampanoags that the English could unleash a plague and destroy them anytime they preferred to do so. And then secondly, as in Jamestown, these local natives, the Wampanoags, hoped to use the English as allies against rival tribes there in Massachusetts, tribes such as the Massachusetts and the Narragansetts and some others. So they managed to survive through that first full year. And when harvest time came in the autumn of 1621, the pilgrims will celebrate, of course, a feast. And Edward Winslow puts it this way. We had a good increase of Indian corn, and our governor sent out 4 men fowling. In one day, they brought back enough fowl to serve the entire company for a whole week. The pilgrims provided roast turkey, duck, geese, clams, eels, garden vegetables, fruits, and nuts. We exercised our arms. In other words, we showed off our weapons. And 90 Indians joined us along with their great king, Massasoit. For 3 days, we feasted and entertained each other. The Indians went out and killed 5 deer for all of us. They have no religion or knowledge of God, yet they're very trusty, quick of understanding, ripe-witted, and very just. Very honest, very just in their dealings. At the end of the feast, the pilgrims prayed thanksgiving to God for, number one, Thomas Hunt's slave ship, which had taken Squanto away from the plague that killed all the rest of his tribe. Wow. The providence of God. And for miraculously bringing Squanto back and helping them to get through that year alive. And secondly, they thank God for the terrible storm that blew them off coast or off course from the massacre that had happened years earlier at Roanoke in North Carolina, the lost colony of Roanoke, and the diseases that were being suffered by the Jamestown settlers a few hundred miles to the south. Thirdly, he prayed and thanked God that even for the merciful deaths of one half of our colonists that first winter, whose food rations saved the rest of us from starvation and death, and lastly, for the bountiful harvest that summer of 1621 and this wonderful opportunity to be able to feast with the local Indians. Now, the pilgrims didn't really refer to this as a Thanksgiving feast. The term was later attributed to it in American history. And also, and some of you probably know this, this wasn't really the first Thanksgiving celebrated in America, because 2 years prior to this, there were about 40 colonists who had left England and sailed to Jamestown. They had been given a grant to 800 acres of land about 20 miles west of Jamestown. So they sailed past Jamestown up the James River and settled this area that was called the Berkeley Hundred. And upon arriving there at the Berkeley Hundred, and this would have been in December of 1619, they set aside a day of Thanksgiving. Okay. So that was actually the first Thanksgiving in American history. Now, a few weeks later, after the pilgrims had celebrated their Thanksgiving feast, a ship appeared on the horizon, and at first they feared that it might be a French reconnaissance vessel. But it turned out to be an English supply ship, a ship called the Fortune, that had been sent by their benefactor back in England named Thomas Weston. And this Fortune, by the way, they describe as a tiny vessel about 30 feet long. So this was another one of these little boats somehow made it across the Atlantic Ocean. It brought 35 more settlers. So they were pretty much able to replenish most of those who had died the first year. But the problem is, very few of these new settlers were separatists, devout Christian separatists. Furthermore, this was very much of a mixed blessing as they saw it, because these 35 English who had just arrived, well, that's 35 more mouths they have to feed. So they gave them a conditional welcome to Plymouth, but realizing that their troubles and travails were, of course, far from being over. Now, by 1622, the natives in the local area were beginning to lose fear of the English and the English God. Both the colonists and the English, both the colonists and the Indians had heard the news from Jamestown earlier that year, in which a third of the Jamestown colony had been massacred. And so tensions began to develop between the pilgrims and the local Indian population. And there were some other complicating factors as well. But eventually, they were able to restore relations with the Indians. I'll skip over a few details here for the sake of time. Now, let's take a look at Plymouth Christianity in particular. Although very few in number, the separatists of Plymouth were immensely influential in subsequent American history. In his Oxford History of the American People, the great Harvard historian Samuel Eliot Morrison called the Pilgrims, quote, the spiritual ancestors of all Americans. The Pilgrim Church was governed democratically. Requirements for church membership were very rigorous. But nonetheless, they were very devout, very committed to their mission, and what that was to be basically Christian missionaries in this new world. Now, having said that, like nearly all Christians back then, though, the separatists were very ardent sacralists. Remember last week we were talking about how there's basically three positions when you talk about the relationship between church and state. There is a system like is prevalent in communist China, the former Soviet Union, the French Revolution, and that's a secularist government, which is very hostile to religion, Christianity in particular. Then the opposite extreme would be Christian sacralism, this very unholy alliance of church and state, or government and religion. So those are the two extremes. And as we said last week, fortunately, America's founding fathers, in their wisdom, established a nation set up under that moderate middle ground, which they called separation of church and state. Again, not to be confused with how that term's been corrupted in modern times. But like nearly all Christians back in these days, the separatists were sacralists. Although they had fled religious persecution back in England, once they established their own community in Plymouth, they were as sacralistic as most all other Christians. One historian, Williston Walker, puts it this way. Neither pilgrims nor the Puritans, who later settled up in the Boston area, neither of them had any thought of establishing liberty for men to do as they please, nor would any general toleration, such as we now justly value, have furnished sufficient motive to have led our ancestors to the New World. Okay. So they set up a civil government under the Mayflower Compact. Anybody who wants to come and conform to their understanding of the authentic Christian faith is welcome to come and be with them. And then a couple of other issues I want to mention very, very briefly here before we wrap things up. The leaders and most prominent members of the Plymouth colony were, of course, professing Christians. And they were motivated by the very noblest of values. Therefore, the leaders of Plymouth resolved to be as selfless as possible and all work for the common good. So for the first 2.5 years, the Plymouth colony basically had an economy based on a communalistic system, or a small c communistic system, you might say. Not to be confused with Marxist communism, obviously. But there was no private property. or any division of labor in the community. Because provisions were so scarce, they agreed that the land would be worked in common. All the produce would be owned in common, and everything would be distributed equally as each person had need. Okay. Now, the result, despite being a very cooperative Christian community, the result was that the colony was totally unproductive. Colonists began pilfering from the storehouses, especially some of the young men who weren't really devout Christians who were along, but nonetheless, colonists began pilfering from the storehouse, and conflicts soon broke out over charges that some of the people weren't working hard enough. So as William Bradford later wrote in his History of Plymouth Plantation, quote, "The experience that was had in this common course and condition tried for sundry years, actually about 2.5-3 years, and that amongst godly and sober men may well evince the vanity of that conceit of ancients such as Plato, for instance, but applauded by others in later times, that the taking away of property and bringing it in community into a commonwealth would make them happy, make everyone happy, and everyone would flourish, as if they were wiser than God," he writes. "For this community, so far as it was found to breed much confusion and discontent and retard much employment that would have been useful for their benefit and comfort." Again, a lot of people were just lazy and slackers and wouldn't do their fair share of the work. "For yet young men that were most able and fit for labor and service did repine, become quite lazy, that they should spend their time and strength to work for other men's wives and children without any recompense." So despite the highest and best of motives, and that is, look, we want to be a community of based on Christian values, the values of the early Jerusalem church, for instance, and we don't want to divvy out private property, and we don't want some people, gaining economically over others. Everybody needs to be equal. Despite all that, within about 2.5 years, they realize it's a dead end. Their colony is totally underproductive. So in 1623, the colony abandoned its original communal system or communistic system and mandated that each man was responsible to provide for his own self and his own family. And the results were absolutely striking. Men and women began to work longer and harder. Those who had often shirked work in the past suddenly became quite industrious. More land was cultivated, more game was hunted and killed, more houses and other buildings were constructed in the community. Once the pilgrims replaced communalism, socialism, essentially, with individual responsibility, the general productivity and well-being of the colony increased dramatically. Therefore, the governing council no longer had to exert as much authoritarian control over the community, and everybody eventually seemed to be more satisfied and happier. So land was parceled out according to the size of each household, only for present use, by the way. It was still not owned perpetually. It was still community property and was not inheritable. But finally, in 1625, then, they grew enough food to feed themselves, trade with the natives, and the move toward private property came just a couple of years later when cattle were introduced into the colony and land was divided up among families for the grazing of livestock. At some point around this time, the land was deeded out as private property to the community's residents. Slowly but surely, the colony built up an economic base on subsistence farming, fur trading, fishing, and the raising of livestock, and so on. And Plymouth continued as an independent colony for about 70 years until finally in 1691 it was incorporated into the Greater Massachusetts Bay Colony. So I hope that's been helpful and informative and actually quite inspiring. These are people of great, great faith. And they understand that this life, that these are not people who buy into the prosperity gospel, the health and wealth pseudo gospel. These are people who understand that we're called to endure suffering in this life, but they do it willingly for the sake of practicing what they would consider to be authentic Christianity. And even in their economic system that they set up, under the best of intentions, a socialistic system, essentially, it's a dismal failure, just as socialism is always a dismal failure because it's out of sync with the realities of human nature. Eventually, they understand that, and they convert to private property and so on. And eventually, the community becomes very stabilized, and in the end, a very successful colony leading up to its incorporation into Massachusetts in 1691. So, sorry, I had to cut a few corners to make it to the deadline, but I think we do have some time for questions, comments. So why don't we open things up accordingly? And here comes the microphone, Jack.
One quick question and also one comment.
Yeah.
I'll do the comment first. It seems as though, if I have my numbers correct, 537 people in Washington, D.C. would do well to revisit this history.
I can't imagine what 537 you're No, you're quite correct. See, socialism does not comport with the realities of human nature. And how many failures does it take before we finally realize that? But please, go ahead.
Which reminds me of the adage that those who don't know history are doomed to repeat it.
Over and over.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so you mentioned, though, something that I misunderstood from a history. Didn't they write the Mayflower Compact while they were on the boat?
They did, yes.
Okay, because I misunderstood you then. I thought you said after they got here, so.
Oh, I meant after crossing the ocean.
Okay, good. All right. Thank you.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, there's Sally back there. Okay.
This is very basic. Was the Jamestown colony primarily Puritans or Pilgrims?
Oh,
I'm sorry, I get them
asking.
Confused so
yeah,
frequently.
Thanks for asking about the Jamestown colony, which was founded in 1607. Now, that was primarily an economic venture sponsored by the English government and certain capitalists in England. It did not have nearly the religious component as a central driving feature that Plymouth did. Now, those colonists who came over to Jamestown, like all Englishmen, they were professing Christians. They were mainstream Anglicans. But the spiritual factor was never as crucial there at Jamestown. They did eventually import their own Anglican minister, you know, and so on. So they were all at least superficially religious, of course, but not to the extent of the Pilgrims. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Jeffrey, is there any history on the...
Is there any history on the evangelism of these folks, or were they a holy huddle? In other words, the 61 folks who came with them that were basically secular or pagans in the Wampanoags, they had a pretty good harvest field. Was there any history on how many of those became pilgrims or became Christians?
Yeah, that's a good question. I'm not aware that William Bradford in his history ever specified that. He indicates that some of those who came over accompanying the Pilgrims did become true Christians. But I'm not aware. I can't remember reading anything that he wrote that specified how many. Also, their local relations with the Indians, the Algonquins. Apparently, very few inroads were made as far as that relationship. So there's no record that there were any sizable, significant conversions to Christianity on the part of local natives. Now, it was different, however, a couple of decades later up in the Boston area. John Eliot, great Puritan leader there in Boston, had a very aggressive and effective evangelistic outreach ministry to local natives. Mm-hmm. But as far as I know, the Pilgrims down in Plymouth were pretty self-contained.
Hey, Jeffrey, I was wondering, going back to Sally's question, why is there such a disproportionate emphasis on the Pilgrims and the Massachusetts colony versus the first Thanksgiving that you mentioned at Virginia at Berkeley Plantation and the Jamestown colony?
Yeah, well, those 40 Englishmen who came over and settled what was called the Berkeley Plantation, 20 miles west of Jamestown, they were only there a brief period of time when the local Indians staged an uprising and slaughtered about one-third of all the English settlers in that area. So those Berkeley Hundred, as they were called, actually it was only about 40, left their plantation and retreated into Jamestown where they could seek shelter and security. By the way, from that group, however, that came over, two later presidents of the United States emerged, William Henry Harrison and later Benjamin Harrison. So they were significant eventually.
Okay. My question is, if my memory serves correctly, I heard not too long ago that there is a huge stone crucifix at Cape Henry as a memorial to the first Christian prayer offered before Plymouth. Is that correct? Do I remember it correctly? What is that at Cape Henry?
Where is Cape Henry? I don't know where Cape Henry is.
Somewhere in I think in Virginia.
Okay. So how far would that be from Jamestown?
45 minutes, an hour.
Okay, well, I'm sorry, I'm not aware of that, but it would not be surprising. Yeah, if that were the case. Pardon me. I didn't quite hear you. I'm sorry.
So I just want to make sure that the Jamestown colony is related to the where the crucifix was erected.
Right. The colonists there in Jamestown, again, they would have all been professing Christians, okay. Loyal members of the Church of England. Some, I'm sure, probably were very, committed, legitimate Christians. But that's really not why the colony was founded. That was never a major, priority in the Jamestown colony. But I wouldn't be surprised at all if they erected, crucifixes or crosses and so on. It's part of their heritage. Yeah. Let's see. Do we have time for maybe one more? Okay.
One of the things that... Am I on?
Yes.
Okay. One of the things that strikes me greatly is we look at this as our first Thanksgiving and the Thanksgiving prayer that was offered. But in the midst of that, it wasn't just thank you for getting us through last year, but it was they thank God for some of the terrible adversity that they went through, the loss of so many people and the fact they got blown off course. So it's so easy to thank God for the good things, but yes, they were able in their faith to thank God for the difficulties and all the things that led to their survival, including the story of Squanto too. So.
Yes.
Just a good reminder for all of us. Absolutely. We say our Thanksgiving prayers.
Yes, thank you. Yeah, I appreciate that. And again, they understand that life is hard, and they're not prosperity gospelers. And so they understand that even the adversity that we encounter in life, God can use in a very redemptive way. God is sovereign, and he uses in a redemptive way even great tragedies by human standards. But he deserves all praise and power and glory and all. You know, God doesn't exactly govern this world the way I would or you would probably. And thank God for that, in addition to all else. But they understand that God is sovereign, and that ultimately his will is accomplished, even though in the short term things might look very bleak and very futile. So thank you. I appreciate that comment.
One more, Jeff.
Oh, okay, one more. Yes.
Just for the computer nerds, I did a quick Google search on Cape Henry, and sure enough, there was a picture of the crucifix that he mentioned. It looks like that was prayer in 1607, and the crucifix was put up in 1935 by the Daughters of the American Colonists or so.
Now, is it a crucifix or just a cross?
Well, it's a cross. It's looks like a big tombstone with a cross on top of it.
Oh, okay.
Whatever the technical term for that is.
Oh, yeah, but not a depiction of Jesus on the cross.
Just a cross.
So just a cross. Okay. Yeah. Okay, thank you. Yeah, appreciate that. Well, wonderful being with you all this morning, and looking forward to our session next week as we finish up this topic. And if you have any residual questions or comments, don't feel reluctant at all to send me an email, and I'll happily and quickly respond. So great blessing being with you all.